The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique.
So in this episode, we've actually got our second pair of collaborative writers working on a novel. So this will link in a way to the episode we did about Macbeth a few episodes ago. So in this episode, we're speaking to Natasha Subramanian and Luke Williams about the novel they wrote, Diego Garcia, and their process of how they put that together.
Yeah, for anyone that's read the book, it's quite a unique approach to collaboration. I mean, I guess every collaborative project is different by its nature. Writing is generally quite a solitary pursuit, and so finding ways to collaborate is invariably going to be something unique. But I think the way that the final text turned out is fairly different. There's two narrators that are sort of biographical, sort of not. There's some big themes going on in there that they've approached in a very different way.
Yeah, I mean, as well as talking about how they collaborated, we also had chats about fighting against the assumptions that underpin literary realism. And a really important thing, I think, for Luke and Natasha in writing this, which was about the limits of empathy in fiction and what they've seen as their move towards solidarity and a sort of radical disidentification, which just felt like the right approach to dealing with someone else's trauma and someone else's struggle.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, there was an interesting point about the sort of how much is hung on empathy in creative writing courses and so on. I mean, obviously, empathy is an important part of writing. You've got to have some empathy to even delve into the world of fiction and start believing in what some other fictional character is doing. But there is a very kind of syrupy, I think they talked about an article that Ian McEwan had written in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, sort of saying, you know, if only people had read more books, they would have the empathy, which
I think they found that almost grotesquely offensive, maybe more than syrupy. I wouldn't want to put words in their mouth about that. But I think there was quite a visceral feeling about that article. And if more people read novels, there would be fewer people, you know, flying planes into buildings.
I think that idea kind of spans across lots of things. If more people read novels, it would be less of, you can apply it to almost anything, and it feels like people do, and it's sort of bland and sweet, and almost nobody's going to argue against it, although obviously when we get into the conversation they very much do. I think that's a very good point.
Maybe that's a good opportunity to get into that conversation. I think as we're talking to you both as a pair who've collaborated on a piece of writing, I'm trying to think whether it's better for us to ask you individually about your roots into writing or to start off with your collaboration. But I think perhaps if you could give us, but each of you, just a bit about your background in writing before you started to collaborate on Diego Garcia.
It might be interesting to know that Luke and I met when we both were on a creative writing course. And that was the beginning of my sort of formalized writing practice. I had wanted for many years to study creative writing and applied to the MA at the University of East Anglia and was accepted in 2000. And there met Luke Williams, and we were in the class that was taught by W.G. Sebald. And I think that's interesting. Yeah, that's a subject in itself, I think, in terms of our relationships to writing and to literature. I think our having studied, been taught by Sebald and having been fans of his work had an impact on our writing, I think. I've always felt myself to be a writer, and I have this perhaps quite romantic sense of vocation. And like most such writers, that came from being a lifelong reader and a very committed reader from an early age. and having this very kind of intense relationships with books. Like many young girls, the first such book was Jane Eyre, and having this relationship with Jane Eyre that was really kind of intense. And my reading experience of Jane Eyre was also quite intense because my father used to be in the Air Force. And as a result, I was sent to boarding school and I went to a convent boarding school and read Jane Eyre in this very kind of Jane Eyre-esque. So I really identified with her. But then, of course, later encountered Jean Rhys's White Sargasso Sea, which was a writing back to Jane Eyre from the point of view of the character who was known as Bertha Mason in Jane Eyre, Antoinette. So then I kind of observed this idea of how reading and writing could be intertwined. And I think that that's my writing practice grew from that through my relationships to text. And in my first novel, which I also ended up, took me a very long time to write, as did Diego Garcia, I think because for different reasons. But in each case, perhaps it's because part of the process involved trying to figure out a form in which the story could be told and actually realizing that the form also affected the story. And so there was this kind of entanglement between the two that takes a while to kind of work out. I'm hoping that process gets easier because otherwise it's, I don't have many books left in me if it takes 10 years to write each one. But with Jeannie and Paul, that was a rewriting or a writing back to or a cannibalistic translation, as I termed it in my critical and creative writing PhD, for which the novel was my thesis, of an 18th century French book called Paul et Virginie by Bernadette Henri de Saint-Pierre, which is a classic of French colonial literature that creates this fantasy of the island of Mauritius, which was then a French colony and then later became a British colony, where my family are from. And it was after writing Jeannie and Paul and my work with Luke on his novel where our friendship, which became a kind of to readership and then a kind of quite a nosy, invasive readership and slash editing, then developed into a collaboration.
That might be a good point. Maybe you go back and explain how you came to the juncture of collaborating or your sort of route into writing. And
yeah, I mean, it very much chimes with what Natasha said, at least the second series of narratives, I suppose, Natasha told about writing life. I started life out not as a reader and certainly not imagining myself as a writer. It came largely by accident for me. I was all set to go on to postgraduate study in colonial history within a discipline of history, but at some point realized, I suppose, wrestling with the sources and particularly the kind of silences that I was first seeking to, I guess, kind of make speak or in any way I could, but then realizing, first of all, that was a morally dubious way of approaching history. And second of all, I literally couldn't make them speak because they remained stubbornly silenced, thinking that perhaps fiction would be a more interesting way to negotiate the historical record. So applied for this MA, was very unfortunate to be taught by Max Sebald, and even more fortunate, I suppose, to be in the same class as Natasha. Went on to write my first novel, again, very much how Natasha said, with her nosy editorship, increasingly nosy editorship, but benefiting hugely from it. But I think for me, the start of perhaps our formal collaboration came towards the end of writing that book, where for various reasons I don't really believe in writer's block. I think I wasn't able to write, but my publisher, who had agreed to publish the book already, was asking for it. So I turned to Natasha, or we had a conversation and somehow concocted this, at the time seemed perfectly natural, and but in retrospect seems a bit mad, for her to write two chapters of this novel, which she did. The novel was published without really my publisher knowing officially Natasha's contribution for various reasons, which we may or may not want to go into, but certainly acknowledged by me, and it went out into the world. And I think the moment when I realized I wanted to keep working with Natasha was the moment when the reviews came in, variously saying the book was good or bad or whatever. But often they would say, well, the two best chapters are, and they would talk about the two chapters that Natasha wrote. So I was like, I've got a choice here. Either I stop writing, either I, you know, plow on my single furrow, or I perhaps keep the collaboration or suggest we might. I think through conversation, that's one reason how Diego Garcia was born, or the idea of it was born.
Going back to when you sort of first met in the class, was did you have an instant sort of sense that, I mean, obviously you weren't thinking in terms of collaborating at that point, but looking back, were you, did you have a relationship different than the other students in the class in any way? You were sort of, I don't know, sitting in one corner at the breakout room and talking about something else while everyone else is working on the study or the exercise, or was it more just a matter of necessity as you say, you got to the point of feeling it was something that would work?
Well, I was very struck by my first seeing Luke, who had hair at the time, and I felt like he really looked like Kafka. And I was really gratified when Sebald said the same thing in one of our tutorials.
I wish he'd said, I wrote like Kafka rather than looking like him.
I mean, there was obvious, we had a connection in terms of what we were interested in talking about in terms of writing. I know that I obviously knew about colonial history from the point of view of my parents having been born in Mauritius, which was then a colony, and knowing about colonial history of Mauritius, but just in terms of the kind of, I guess, the concept of historiography and approaches to histories, we'd have conversations around that. We'd have conversations around, recommended some really amazing books that I remember you were a real Robert Walser fan and also Bruno Schultz fan. And yeah, these were writers I hadn't read before.
For me, I think I agree. I also was very struck by Natasha, like the way she looked in class. I can't say I compared you to any writer that I already knew, but I somehow felt, oh, there's a writer. You know, when you first go into the classroom, you're looking around for the real writers in that kind of naive way. What is a real writer? Someone who writes. I think that's true to say. But I do think, yeah, we became part of, there was a bunch of us there who somehow were able to meet beyond class and who we grew friendships. But I do think between Natasha and I, there was a particular understanding. I would actually say not because our work and our interests necessarily chimed, but I think we were
the opposite.
Yeah. The opposite. Yeah. What I do think we were both doing is wrestling with form, to go back to something you said earlier, which is to say trying to find a form adequate to what we wanted to speak about or to our imaginations, I suppose, at that time. And I could say that I was enthralled to certain writers, which now I wouldn't find particularly interesting. And I would say would be the same for Natasha, very different traditions. But I do think, in a way, our friendship and then our subsequent collaboration, as much as a process of producing novels or producing writing, was a process of finding a form and, in the end, a mutual form to house our collective imaginations, which can't also be divorced from our political commitments, I would say.
Process of finding the form, is that, I mean, in the early stages, I guess the two questions, how is that process of finding the form changed? And was that initially, was it just a case of almost trying to ape writers that you sort of appreciated or admired, to trying to write something in the form of a writer and then seeing what worked? What were the sort of initial steps to finding that form, you know, before you hit on collaborating?
I think that idea of kind of wrestling with this idea of form was also wrapped up in becoming aware of an increasing, stronger word than disenchantment, but actually kind of recognizing the problematic nature of literary realism, how we were struggling with this as a kind of mode of writing that felt like a kind of quite dominant mode at the time.
Anyone who's been around or associated with creative writing degrees, postgraduate, undergraduate, postgraduate creative writing pedagogy, would understand that the tradition, both in terms of like literary tradition, but in terms of disciplinary, academic disciplinary traditions that it emerges from. And I'm sure everyone's aware that it kind of comes from America, the Iowa School of Creative Writing, the kind of classic American social realist short story tradition is very strong. So I think Natasha and I both felt, yeah, disenchanted with that tradition well before we came onto the degree. And I think having W.G. Sebald as our tutor was a really beautiful way of negotiating that disenchantment, because of course he himself was disenchanted and sought new forms, new modes of expression, account for what was Sebald, that kind of historical, the weight of European historical history, both colonial, but of course focused perhaps on the Holocaust, which you can't disassociate with colonialism. Hitler famously admired the British Empire and sought that as a model for his future Reich. So yes, a disenchantment with social realism, but not perhaps knowing how to speak around that, not knowing how to respond to that in a way that felt truthful to our own experience, but also somehow able to not just resist or write back to that tradition, which is to say, not just react to something, but try and forge something from a different line. And I think part of, you know, Natasha referred to some of the writers that I introduced her to. I would also say Natasha introduced me to a bunch of writers. And I think the types of conversations that we were having whilst we were studying, but much more so once we finished studying and emerged to a practice beyond the academy, was definitely trying to sidestep that form, because there are so many other traditions, both in the Western tradition and non-Western traditions, both in oral traditions and non-textual traditions. The art world has been hugely influential on Natasha Rye, the way artists approach material, matter, and politics and life. We try to harness all of these things that we're reading, watching, learning, conversing about, and to try and, not create something completely new. I would never for once would even want to do that. That's a lie, I think, but not rely on a tradition that felt quite constricting, but one that we were both beholden to in some ways.
Was that disenchantment initially, was it in terms of the sort of politicization, the direction that realist novels and texts tend to go, or more with the actual idea that you could ever really have a realist? It was something that was not fundamentally worth aiming for as a sort of structure or a concept.
It's that this mode, as though between realism, seeks to present the world as it is, reality as it is, when in fact it's just one very specific and very kind of politically, this idea of a universalism that literary realism seeks to kind of, the kind that we were encountering then, that we were challenging.
I would say the easiest way of describing this and also encapsulating the moment was 9/11 happening around when we were both studying in Norwich beginning. I remember being in Norwich and finding that it happened. In fact, I might even been at your flat. There was one particular writer, Ian McEwan, who was associated very much with the university we were studying at, UEA, who wrote an article in The Guardian days after about 9/11, which essentially said, and you can go back and read it, and I have recently, essentially the reason for 9/11 and the reason that the bombers did what they did was because they had a lack of empathy for their victims, and kind of seemed to conclude that if they'd read more novels, and perhaps more novels by Mr. Ian McEwan, they may not have blown up those Twin Towers. So that really, not necessarily at the time, but certainly in retrospect, kind of seemed to congeal this moment of dissatisfaction and actually, frankly, disgust with that tradition, which thinks that if you only read good fiction that wrestles with reality, your empathy grows and you can be good human beings. And for me, that, you know, in much the same way as present in the present conflict, or the present kind of inflaming of the conflict in Israel-Palestine, where the context for the, you know, the atrocities that Hamas have committed is almost always not accounted for in, certainly in journalism and many commentary. So I felt in that article, I think we felt that the context for those bombings was reduced to something very, very narcissistic on the behalf of Ian McEwan. So I think that idea of empathy being the apogee of what fiction can do, and the idea that fiction creating empathy and suddenly the world would be a better place seems very problematic. And I think empathy in fiction is something Natasha and I have been thinking a lot about. And I don't think it's something to be avoided, but I don't think it's perhaps the most useful way of thinking about what fiction can do. And I think we've moved from thinking about empathy to solidarity.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question, that's the depths of which there is no sort of bottom to that question around empathy. Because I mean, for me, I think it's a hugely important part in terms of, if you're thinking in terms of plot and structure and driving things forward, empathy is what a lot of emotional movement relies on in a novel. And when it's good, it's good, and when it's bad, it's manipulative. And even when it's manipulative, it can still be good within the context of the story. I mean, you have very sort of simple Disney stories, and say as an adult, you can see what strings are being pulled and manipulation that's going on, but yet you still respond to it and you still say that was a good Disney film, but I'm not going to live my life by it necessarily. But I can see what they've done to push the story forward with manipulating your empathy. I don't think there's ever an end to that question, because you can't get rid of empathy, but you can't just put it on a pedestal and say, look, there's empathy, let's all worship around the pedestal, because it leads to some bad outcomes.
I think the distinction between empathy and solidarity, I think, became clearer for Luke and I when we were kind of thinking in terms of, and this gets back to the idea of our collaboration, actually, thinking through this question together and recognizing for us that empathy recognized on a kind of individuation of emotion and experience, whereas solidarity is, we were trying to do in our book, was to try and kind of think about how one might respond as part of a kind of a collective response.
I totally agree with you, Lachlan, that, you know, I don't think empathy in itself is something that we should like lay into and put to bed. But no. I do think the way it is kind of highlighted or even fetishized, especially among creative writers, but also, of course, among advertisers and government spokesmen, is something that we should put into question. And I think Natasha was exactly right to talk about the individual versus the collective when thinking about empathy. I think empathy relies, I suppose, works in two ways. And the first way would be that it's relying on almost always an individual experience. So when we empathize with someone in a novel, it's usually empathizing with the protagonist or perhaps, you know, another character. I guess you put it really well, Lachlan, when you were talking about, you know, Disney. We're drawn into the story because that character somehow speaks back to our own experience. But it's very much always located in the individual. And I think the second, I guess, way that empathy pivots draws on that. And it's by definition that you somehow understand that experience. Whereas what Natasha and I encountered with the Chagos story was something that empathy could never help us with. One, because it was a collective story, which is to say there was no one protagonist in this story which we wanted to highlight, although there were many, many individuals with extraordinary experiences that we might have drawn on. But the second and really the most important aspect was we are not Chagossians. We have not been deracinated directly. We have not been removed from our own island. And that experience
to a life of degradation and poverty we have not undergone any of these experiences and this kind of lifelong struggle for the right to return to their homelands.
When I was really young, William Burroughs told me, and I was really struggling, we never had any money, and William, the advice that William gave me was build a good name. You know, keep your name clean. Don't make compromises. Don't worry about making a bunch of money or being successful. Be concerned with doing good work and make the right choices.
So in order to tell this story, we didn't want us or our readers to be put in their place and say, I understand that. We didn't want that response. What we wanted is to recognize the radical otherness of that experience for Natasha and I. Variously, we have very different backgrounds and experiences and relationships to colonialism, of course. But what I think we wanted was not for that recognition to place, but a kind of radical disrecognition of that experience, and yet to be acting in solidarity with those people. So empathy relies on saying, yes, I understand, because that's a bit like this. Therefore, I will put my heart out to that and maybe help when I have time and my kids aren't scrabbling over me and I've got some spare money to give to charity, and then I can get on with my life. Solidarity is a much more active response that doesn't require identification, but a radical disidentification. And I think working collaboratively and engaging with a story that can only be understood collectively, and we could talk maybe about what we mean by that more precisely and later if it feels relevant, led to this kind of distinction that we feel is really important for this work and work going forward between empathy and solidarity.
Was that and a kind of an anger about the political situation of the Chagossians?
Absolutely.
Did you start by wanting to explore that through fiction, and then you found the form that you felt sat with what you wanted to achieve, kind of small p politically with that? Or did it sort of take form and you realized that was something you were interested in and wanted to bring in?
If you're asking about the process of how we kind of thought through and approach to producing this book, it starts with this moment of recognizing, learning about the Chagossian struggle and this historic event that has continuing legacies, and realizing that many people that we encountered in our, let's say, kind of professional and social spheres as writers and teachers and working with artists, working with people who outside of the Chagossian community, outside of the Mauritian community, whose story is also connected to the Chagossian, these are people who politically engaged, politically committed, really committed to decolonization, who did not know this story, did not know about the Chagossian struggle. And so then it became a question of what can we do as writers? How can we help? You know, in the face of encountering injustice and horror and trauma, and if it's not something that you've experienced directly, instinct is, how can I help? What can I do? And we are writers, and we are trained writers, we're trained novelists, and we were clearly writing something that would help to circulate the story in a way that doesn't seek to speak for the Chagossians or over the Chagossian people or appropriate experience, how to find a form to circulate this. And then we realized the story is out there. It's on, that there have been many, many court cases undertaken by the Chagossian people against the UK government. Court cases, the court case at the International Court of Justice, there are transcripts, there are testimonies by Chagossian people who experienced the expulsion firsthand. There are poems, there are songs, there's music in the Sega tradition. What we thought we could do with the book was somehow find a way to point the reader towards this and take on some of the labor of trying to kind of circulate this history and make people aware.
Just to pick up on what Natasha said there and circle it back to what we were saying about form, and one book that Natasha introduced me to was Ursula Le Guin's The Carrier Bag of Queer Fiction.
It's funny because I came across that text after we'd written the book, so it informed the writing of the book, but it speaks to this idea of kind of gathering.
I don't know if you guys know the essay, but she's opposing what she's calling the spear method of writing, which she broadly associates with a masculine tradition of following a hero through their journey.
She is building on anthropological research that actually posits that the first kind of piece of technology or object was not the spear, it was probably a receptacle in terms of gathering.
Not a carrier bag, though.
Well, no. And then from there, started to kind of explore the idea of the kind of hero, the warrior hero narrative. And then,
as opposing that warrior hero narrative, which is characterized by the spear, the kind of masculine killing wild animals and so on and so on, she opposed a feminist and a feminine practice of gathering berries and putting them in a gourd and ultimately bringing it up to contemporary times into a carrier bag. So I think when Natasha was talking about us trying to take account, I guess, of all the many narratives in different forms that we were trying to gather and write alongside, thinking of the novel as a receptacle and a place for gathering all of these different forms, narratives, and so on, was quite a revelatory moment for me, even though Natasha now has reminded me that was kind of retrospective. Somehow I feel like we should have or did know about that essay before.
In a technical sense, I just wondered if we could ask about how you started working together collaboratively. How do you even begin sort of drafting and things like that? You know, are you sharing a document? Are you meeting up in person? I mean, I don't know, you might have been living close together at the time or whatever. How do you start to even begin to shape it?
We didn't develop a methodology from the outset, which we then followed. And that's part of what took so long to write this book. Sort of evolved for what we might need, whatever we needed at the time. And in fact, it didn't start off, we didn't start off thinking we were writing a novel straight away. Luke wrote a text and shared it with me. And then I started to edit and write into it. And then it became this thing.
Just jump in there. When you say shared the text, was that a Word document? And when you were adding into it, were you using comment feature on the side?
I remember my daughter was a small baby at the time, and I was living in Camden, and sometimes my daughter and I would take my daughter to go and visit Luke on his lunch break at Birkbeck, and we'd sit in the park and have coffee. And then he showed me this thing that he'd started writing, and he said, I'll take the baby and get you a coffee and lemon cake if you can just, you know, what can you do here? And then I just put in this kind of scene.
So you would take Luke's physical laptop and he would go away.
So that's one instance. But then...
But yes, you would, definitely.
Sometimes without his consent, you know, take it off. What are you doing there, you know?
You come back and think, this is genius. I don't remember writing this.
Can I say something first, though? It is true that it emerged really organically like that. But the text that I wrote and shared with Natasha still had in it the idea that it would be a collaboration. It wasn't a text that I thought would just be my own. Partly because when I sat down, and I can only say it was a moment of inspiration because it wasn't completely planned. What really began, I think, this collaboration on Diego Seer was the grammar of it, the specific grammar, which for those who know the book will know that it shifts between the first person plural and the third person singular, the he and the she and the we, and they weave in and out. So that grammar came right at the beginning in the very first few sentences. And I think, although we had no idea it would become a collaborative novel length project or even a novel, we did know, or I certainly was very keen to begin a collaboration, of even if we didn't know how it would manifest.
So in that first draft, you had written he, she, they within that on your own. There wasn't any sort of idea this is going to be collaborative and I'll be writing the he part, Dasha write the she part, anything like that.
It was an invitation to collaborate, and it wasn't a whole draft. The start of chapter, what became chapter one.
4,000 words.
And we worked on that together, and then that's what became Debt, which was the first chapter, which we published with the White Review.
And at that stage, you didn't have any idea of, look, I'll be writing this part, Natasha, I'll be writing this part.
No. We did, the whole thing was from the point of those kind of opening sections was fully collaborative, in the sense that there are parts that we can identify as, oh, I initiated that bit or I initiated that bit. But in the end, the rewriting and overwriting and moving around and so on. And one thing to also make clear is that there is a kind of, it's important to highlight that, you know, this is a novel at the heart of which is a fact, this fact of the Chagossian forced exile. But in the UK, the book is published by Fitzcarraldo, in the US, Semiotext. But in the UK, with Fitzcarraldo, they publish books with blue covers and white covers, as is definitely a novel. But it is something that draws quite heavily on our lived experience. That felt very important to do. And so we have two writer friends. And the idea is as well in the book that they are trying to think through how to express solidarity. And I won't go into the details of the story here, but a long-winded way of saying that it wasn't the case that I wrote the she bits and he wrote the he bits either.
From the start, I guess you'd already sort of collaborated on the two chapters. So it felt quite... did you feel sort of going into it, there was momentum, you know, it's maybe whether it's an essay or a longer essay, or it's going to be something, or was it kind of, well, this, who knows, this might all end up in bin or might not?
What happened was, it was amazing to have this text published in the White Review, because we love that magazine. And at the, forget which issue it was, but it was when Jacques Testard and Ben Easton were the editors. And at the launch party for that issue, Jacques came up to us and said, I'm planning on starting a publishing house. And if ever you think, if this is a part of, this is a part of a novel, I want to see that novel. Would you be interested in kind of sharing it with me? And so I want to highlight how, as a conversation about process, also how the knowledge that we were publishing the book with Fitzcarraldo as well, I think allowed us a certain freedom in terms of how we, in terms of experimentation, in terms of exploring the different strategies that might help us.
Do you mean by that, because Fitzcarraldo was publishing books that were experimental, or do you mean, or do you mean the kind of freedom and I guess leeway that Jacques himself offered us to take as much time as we want and so on?
All of that. Yeah, I wouldn't be the book it became if it hadn't been commissioned by Fitzcarraldo, I believe.
One really quick point was, actually what's really interesting is it was only after Jacques had heard us read or perform the chapter,
yes,
with the caveat we're not performers, so we're not a highfalutin performer. I think reading a collaborative novel and trying to be true to that grammar of the novel that we've already talked about kind of forced us to think about how to present it. And in the end, we presented it jointly, reading jointly, sometimes in dissonance, you know, not reading the same words, literally.
We worked with a great sound artist called Jamie Hamilton, who helped us find a way to translate this collaboration into a kind of sound, into a reading.
Exactly. But the point I was trying to make was, it was only after Jacques had seen us read or perform it that he then came up to us and said, is this going to become a novel? I want to publish it. And I don't think that's because he didn't enjoy reading or editing the written version, but I think it was only through the kind of way of presenting it collaboratively unlocked something about the novel for him and understanding.
Did he say that to you, or is that?
Yeah, no, he said that to me, yeah.
Oh, okay, right. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
He said,
I don't think I knew that, yeah.
Okay. But why I'm highlighting that is because when we talk about it being a process, or the process being as, or if not more important than, I guess, the product, that in a very real sense, it's true, because it wasn't just the writing of the book. It was the performing of the book, or the reading aloud of the book, that was part of the way of producing it, the literary production of it. And beyond that, we quickly realized, and extrapolating from that, it wasn't at all just the writing of the book. Natasha talked about me looking after her young child. Natasha also did the same for my young child. It was collaboration we see now much more clearly than at the time was only in part a textual collaboration, and much more a collaboration between two friends, two people who are thinking together, two people who are activists, and were trying to find a way to marshal that type of collective experience in conversation with one another, but also many others, in a text that somehow people wanted to read.
I also want to add to that, in terms of this thinking beyond book as a kind of product, and thinking in terms of process, and it's an ongoing process, because one of the reasons, obviously, for writing this book is to circulate the story, and to also have conversations and begin conversations, or create opportunities for conversations. For example, Sabrina Jean, who's the UK head of the Chagos Refugee Group, we were in conversation with her while writing the book, or I was, but then we were also in conversation with two documentary filmmakers who had made films about the Chagosians story, Michel Deron and Olivier Magis. And it was great to be able to work with the ICA, for example, to have a screening of both films, and a conversation with Sabrina, and also with the kind of question of connecting up struggles as well. Solidarity as a way of how solidarity manifesting as a way of connecting up struggles.
I wonder, in terms of one question we ask a lot in terms of other authors we speak to, is how do you know you're at the start of a new project, a new novel, or a new piece of writing? I mean, obviously, it's in this case, it seemed quite, the impetus was the injustices and the situation around Chagosians, and that sort of fueled you into the writing process. And that's quite a unique, specific to this novel. I guess I've got a few questions around your work post the novel. One, how do you know when you're starting something new? Does it tend to be around an issue, some activism? And also, in terms of the collaborative approach, do you feel, having worked on this, that should a new idea come up, you would be able to recognize, oh yeah, that's clearly something I've got to collaborate on with someone? Or is it unique to your relationship between the two of you, that you would only really understand collaborating in the way that you've collaborated together, but you couldn't imagine going, okay, this new idea has come to me, and the person I need to collaborate with is, you know, this American academic or something, say, and you approach them and try to collaborate? Or would that just seem bizarre and a strange way to go about it?
Just like to jump in there and say, I don't feel entirely comfortable identify as an activist. I'm a writer.
Is it fair to say the impetus for Diego Garcia, though, came from activism, yes, maybe the wrong word, but came from the understanding of the situation there in the first instance, and that became the impetus.
Yeah, the work was politically motivated for sure. In terms of whether, that's a really interesting point that you raise about whether collaboration for us means just working with one another. I think we, Luke and I, would both be quite suspicious of that, because I think there's a form, one of the reasons for collaborating was to try and to kind of open ourselves up to the world. This quote that we have in the book, consent not to be single being, we want to kind of think beyond ourselves, and the kind of fetishizing of the self characterizes some of the kind of fiction that we don't really trust, let's say. But it's still kind of quite early. We only published the book in last May, and in our lives, quite a lot has happened since then. But we already know that there are two projects that we want to work on together, one of which may involve, I guess, being in conversation is a form of collaboration as well, as a kind of way of inviting people into the collaboration. So we have we've just started to kind of think about a book, which we won't talk about here because we're due a meeting to really kind of think it through together, but it will involve us being in conversation with others and other groups, political groups, in a way that we have also started doing through our kind of shared teaching and workshop practices. So there's different ways of collaborating, let's say.
Do you have those kind of marked folders on your computer where there's the ones... Oh, these are projects I'm going to work on with Luke, and these ones are...
Oh, Lachlan, I'm not that organized.
That's something I'm just going to focus on my own, or does that...
We differ in the sense that there is one thing that I really want to write, and I want to write it on my own. And I want to kind of... I've taken some time off teaching this year in order to be able to kind of have a bit of headspace. And suddenly this idea has kind of worked its way through the cracks, and I feel like I need to attend to it before my teaching partial sabbatical is over. So I'm going to try and, it's a novella. And so that will just be me writing alone, but it will totally be in conversation with Luke. I'll be kind of thinking, we don't have folders, but we have lots of WhatsApp groups. We've got like multi-form WhatsApp groups and channels. So there's one WhatsApp channel for this novella where I'm kind of thinking aloud, making notes to myself, because I'm quite, I don't think you can send WhatsApp to yourselves, can you?
I mean, I was going to say that's not something we've come across. We talk in depth of different approaches of how writers structure their, you know, creation, editing and so on. WhatsApp, I guess because WhatsApp is inherently a communication tool rather than a sort of file storage. It's not something we've come across before.
Also really practically, it just archives everything. So like, yeah. It seems, you know, touch wood, that it's safer than email.
You've not changed phone though and had that. I mean,
I have that thing. Yeah.
I don't work. I archived it and sent it.
Yeah. Thankfully.
I am quite aware that we haven't really explained the context. And one of the things that you said, Natasha, was that you had lots of quite sort of, you know, engaged friends who just didn't seem to know anything about the situation for the Chagos Islanders. So if you have... if you can think of a good place for us to direct people to.
The Chagos Refugee Group website is the first place.
So that website that Natasha mentioned right at the end there, we'll put information about that and other details about their writing, their book and the Chagossian struggle in the show notes. Thank you to them for joining us and thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you. You can find out more on our website, unsignedmethods.co.uk, or we're on Twitter at unsignedmethods. You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm also on LinkedIn and Twitter. Yeah. You'll find me on the same sort of handles.
You can find my writing at jamiebatchin.com is my website, at Jamie Batchin on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchin on Instagram, for whatever that's worth. It's mostly me juggling these days. and thank you again for listening. Catch us next time.